Well, good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for showing up at this particular panel, which will be about Aaron Swartz and his prosecution and things related to that. I'm Randall Swartz, not related. I got CH in my name, okay? It's not like Aaron's with just a W. Okay, there we go. So, and to my right, I'll let her introduce herself.
I'm Christina. I'm a criminal defense attorney, and I'll be talking and answering questions about the legal aspects of Aaron's case.
All right, who did that? All right. So I want to start by actually sort of going through a little bit of his history. Actually, that's back again. Somebody, is that somebody's phone? Is that my phone? Okay, all right. Maybe we want to start by actually sort of finding out what you came here to listen the most about, by maybe toss out the questions. You just want us to just wing it and cover whatever we're going to cover up here today. No? Anybody? Well, that worked really well, didn't it? All right.
Brilliant.
You're such a participative audience. Thank you all for coming. All right. So let's go over basically the sort of the background. And I'm not doing much more than staring at Wikipedia and reading various facts about him. I actually didn't know him or know of his actions. But I'm particularly intrigued by this case because I had, that's nice, I had my own prosecution 15 years ago, and some of you who have been coming to DragonCon for a long time know that I've talked at least on two different occasions about my prosecution for doing what I thought was an innocent act and then getting into a real huge pile of trouble. So we'll go back a little bit here, and I'm looking at his history page here. So he's apparently been involved in a lot of things throughout the web's history. He's worked with the W3C for a while, that's the World Wide Web Consortium. He worked on the RDF, an XML medium type registration. RDF was supposed to be this universal metadata that you could place on web pages that never really caught on that I have any awareness of. So it was a triumph for a while as being the way to get more automated material everywhere. And it's still used in some small parts of the markets, but I don't see it sort of being the general solution that it was trying to be. Something near and dear to me is he wrote Markdown with John Gruber. So John Gruber has a really great blog I read every day. And Markdown, of course, is written in Perl, so that means I like this guy already, okay, because he writes code in Perl. Yeah, cool. He apparently went to Stanford for a while and created Infogami, which sounds pretty interesting. I think I've actually played with some of their stuff. And he worked on the Internet Archive Open Library Project and the web.py web framework. Okay, now it's down a couple notches because now he's on Python. Okay. Then his company merged with Reddit, and I know that some places incorrectly reported this as him having co-founded Reddit, but no, he was an owner of Reddit, not one of the guys that actually worked on the original code, although he might have had some incidental stuff for doing that. Then he's been involved in things like Watchdog.net, founded that to create something that actually he says got him in trouble later, which is the Open Access Guerrilla Manifesto, which means that he was very interested in making sure that data was open. I really like that. I stand behind that sort of stuff too, except I just don't write manifests because I don't want to get any more trouble. Okay. And then he formed the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. And his quote here is, "I spend my days experimenting with new ways to get progressive policies enacted and progressive politicians elected." And so he basically became an online activist, which is really, again, good stuff. He co-founded Demand Progress, and he was instrumental in helping stop the Stop Online Piracy Act, SOPA. I like that because my Congressman Ron Wyden was also one of the guys that helped get it stopped, so I'm happy to be from Oregon and have Ron Wyden in there fighting on my behalf. And he did a lot of work for Wikipedia and for the Library of Congress, but you could have all read this directly from the Wikipedia page. I think we should talk more about the impact of the case law, and some of the things he probably was going through and some of the things I can relate to as well. You want to cover some of the legal parts of it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that one thing that, just to go back to some of the things that you were just talking about, he was a former child prodigy. He was doing this from the time that he was 14, and so it was very much an integral part of who he was and his life, the work that he was doing. I guess everyone's job is really, really important to them, but in particular, we were just talking about this before, but he was ultimately prosecuted for something that fell within his profession, so I just found that to be extremely I don't know, compelling and an incredibly important part of his case. You guys haven't had a question?
I'd like to add something. Yeah, I was a part of Chicago Force, where Star Wars fan group. He was our webmaster. Mm. I only met him maybe once or twice. His parents dropped him off to one of our members, part of our Jedi Council. I mean, I was a nice kid, you know. I was the person that would write up articles on our events, so I would send him, you know, can you please put this up on the website or take this one down, it's over. I mean, like I said, this nice kid, I didn't really know, you know, well, like I said, I only met him once or twice. And after a while, he got too busy doing his other stuff, so he had to step down. So obviously, he was a Star Wars fan. That was a big, you know, he was a part of our still with group, just still going strong. I didn't know about all this other stuff that was going on until after I knew he was a super genius, and he was doing, you know, also lectures and all sorts of stuff. And it was odd, because when I first heard of his passing, I just heard it from other Chicago Force members. And then it started hearing the news, and I didn't know about all this stuff. And all of a sudden, when someone you know is all of a sudden reporting on the news and everything, and you realize, wow, I didn't really, you know, it was, like I said, I didn't know about any of this stuff until after the fact. Yeah. But yeah, nice kid, though.
Thanks for sharing that. I also want to address something that you brought up just a moment ago, and that is that I can't say I'm anywhere in the same league as Aaron. I've accomplished quite a bit in my life, too. And I started really early. And part of that blinds you to, has a tendency to blind you towards normal behavior and normal what people normally accomplish instead of what you're accomplishing. And I can see that might have led up to him doing some of the things for which he was eventually accused as being criminal activity. So I can definitely relate to that as well.
So I guess we should move into talking a bit about his case. Mm-hmm. So at the time that it happened, he was working in Boston. He was a fellow at Harvard, working on working basically in a research lab, looking at one of the things he was looking at was the impact of big money on the academic research and academic literature. And so there's some conjecture that part of the reason why he was so interested in, or why he had downloaded the documents from JSTOR, was because he was going to do, that was part of his research, or at least that was what led him to want to download from JSTOR as opposed to other repositories or databases of documents or articles. So he was working in Boston at Harvard, and the story kind of starts at MIT, where they noticed that there were significant numbers of documents being downloaded from JSTOR, which is a gigantic, if anyone doesn't know about it, it's a gigantic online database that stores academic articles from all sorts of different types of journals.
Full text searches of almost 2,000 journals, so this is definitely a big database.
Yeah, and ACA.
Question?
Yeah, sorry.
Question?
It's my understanding he had legal access to that at the time, right?
Yes. That's what makes this case crazy.
Yeah, the allegation is that he exceeded the authority that he was given. So he acted outside of... whatever access he legally had or had been given by JSTOR or by any of the universities that he was affiliated with, the allegation is that the way that he used that access exceeded what it was that he was authorized to do. That was in one of the most recent indictment.
So I take that falls into the agreement he signed when he signed up, right? And so was that actually clearly defined in the user agreement, like a bandwidth usage, or, you know?
My understanding is that when the Secret Service eventually got involved, that one of the questions that the Secret Service followed up with JSTOR about was, how would somebody have known whether or not they were exceeding, breaking the law, doing something, well, actually, breaking the law is not exactly right, whether or not they were breaking the terms of use. And JSTOR, if I'm not mistaken, said that, look, you get pop-ups, you get screens that tell you what you're allowed to do, that this is authorized access through a university, and reminded them. Now, I've never read the exact disclosures or disclaimers that were on the various login screens, but that is what JSTOR was saying. Look, that's how he would have known that what he was doing wasn't permitted. To get a little bit technical, one of the other ways that they alleged that he had violated terms of use were that he had or had somehow evaded the security measures that were in place, were that he had modified his MAC address, did some MAC address spoofing to, because they, when they first detected it, they shut down that one particular IP address. He went ahead and got a new IP address, and at some point along the chain did some MAC address spoofing, and when he kept realized, they say that when he realized that he kept getting shut down, that he eventually modified the program that he was using to automatically retrieve these records and kind of throttled down the number of records that he was collecting so that it didn't get picked up by whatever automated systems JSTOR had put in place.
As far as the charges against them, do you know if they were like per download or per day? How do they come up with the individual charges?
No, it was not per download. Let me actually have the indictment. It was not per download, no. Although the number of downloads plays into the seriousness of the offense, when they calculate the monetary damages, they figure out how much damage did this many downloads cost, how much would a university have paid for that much access, and in order for it to be, especially under state law, in order for something to be, he was actually charged with in one of the counts with larceny, or at least that was his state charges that came first. He was actually charged with larceny, and the way that got to be felony larceny was that they alleged that it was the damages, or that what was attempted to be taken was over a certain amount of money. So that's how the number of downloads plays into his case.
Now, I could be misremembering something, but was he not involved in some other kind of downloading of like public domain documents earlier and posting those? What's that?
Yeah.
The Pacer Archive?
The Pacer Archives?
Yeah, that was never charged. Pacer, yeah, there were allegations that he had participated in downloading a relatively large number of Pacer documents, which Pacer is a, I can't remember what the acronym stands for.
Public Access to Court Electronic Records.
Yeah, they're all court cases, court filings, briefs, things like that that get filed in only in federal cases. But all of those things are typically public domain, right? We pay for, as citizens, our tax dollars pay for the legislature to write the statutes and our judges to issue their opinions, and so that's all public access, and that's not copyrighted, although there are people trying to copyright it now, but that's not copyrightable material. And he was one of the accusations, and he was actually never charged with it. The FBI looked into that and apparently found that no laws had been broken, and there were no charges that came from that.
Yeah, it said all the documents were in fact public, so how could the FBI actually prosecute anything there? Although, using any logic you want, you could probably have found a way to prosecute them anyway.
There's another question.
So, something I find kind of, I guess, disgusting in a bit is that, like, it's not technically larceny because the company still has the object, you're creating a digital copy of it. So I know you're a lawyer, and I actually have seven lawyers in my family, so I, but I,
sorry.
I, yeah, yeah. But I personally feel that the law is just decades behind where it should be on this issue.
Well, that was interesting in my case as well, and because we went over that real carefully with my legal team, is that if theft means depriving the original owner of their value of it, then what is a copy of something if it doesn't do anything to diminish the original value of the original? So I could see it in a case where, say, you're pre-releasing a movie and now the opening night's not going to be as big. There's an actual monetary damage there. But in terms of a copy of something that hundreds of other people made copies of, yeah, I can't see the definition of theft fitting that.
Now, JSTOR's argument is that what their concern was that he apparently had downloaded something like 80% of the JSTOR database over the course of a number of months, and that he had such a large number of their, or such a large portion of their database, that if he were to release that to the public for free, he had done interviews in which that had been discussed about trying to gather as much information from these public databases as possible and releasing that for everybody to use. JSTOR's initial concern had been that if that got released, then they have no more product that they would sell to universities. And the reason why at the end of the day JSTOR did not ask for criminal prosecution or any civil, and actually he had settled with JSTOR any civil suits, and JSTOR had said once they got back what it was that he had downloaded, then there was no longer any concern that what he had downloaded was going to be released and diminish their product. So yes, I agree that is, I'm just explaining JSTOR's side of that, or why that went on until JSTOR knew exactly what he had, where it was, and knew that it couldn't be released.
And although some people reported that it was a significant amount of JSTOR's documents, apparently it was less than 1%. So we're talking a tiny fraction of what JSTOR had in terms of value.
Back one row. More question.
Was there any discussion when figuring out the monetary value? I understand that JSTOR is providing a service on top of essentially academic publications, which in turn are provided freely by the academic personnel to JSTOR. And
right.
Was there any discussion on the fact that a lot of those publications were probably funded by federal grant money and in turn be public domain anyway?
Right. I think that's an incredibly interesting argument, because it's the same argument that you have with Pacer, right? If the public pays for this, then it would not be copyrightable material. And yes, you're right, a significant portion of the research that gets done that results in those articles is all funded by public money. But the only real discussion, at least in the federal indictment, the only real discussion of where that money comes from is they talk about the amount of money that a university the size of MIT might expect to pay JSTOR for annual access, and they threw around a number of $50,000, if I'm remembering everything correctly.
So then doesn't that raise the legality of JSTOR in the first place if they're selling public domain things for this exorbitant amount of money?
I can sell you Wikipedia articles if you're still enough to, you know,
But doesn't that raise the question, there should be a public domain database for all these anyway?
So researchers can host it on their university website with a Creative Commons license. So a lot of NIH and other nationally funded research, it is public domain, but you might have to go through a database besides JSTOR to find it. So it's harder to find, but it's out there.
The way Pacer works is that if you access it at certain locations, then each of your downloads is free. If you access it through other methods, then the download is something like 10 cents a page, which with that one, when they initially calculated that one, it came up to something like $1.5 million that somebody would have paid for that number of downloads.
Wow.
But again, all public domain, and really what you're paying for, at least with the Pacer stuff, I guess the argument would be that what you're paying for that 10 cents is you're paying for that that system to be up and running to allow you access, but you obviously have free ways that you can get it by going to actually to the Court of Appeal, local Court of Appeals you could go, or certain libraries have access to Pacer for free as well.
One of the things that's interesting that I'm seeing in the docs about this is that he did this by camping a laptop inside a closet at MIT. MIT had access to JSTOR, and I'm not sure why he didn't just do it at Harvard where he was at, or not, was it Harvard?
Yeah, he was at Harvard, but
I think he had faster access over MIT.
There was no access at Harvard?
No, I think he had faster access at MIT.
Yeah, okay. Oh, faster access. Okay, that's probably better then. Thanks for explaining that. But that to me is, you know, that's suspicious behavior, but again, probably not at the level of the criminal prosecution they had.
Well, one of the questions I have and that I find very intriguing is the government has written a law that says basically unauthorized access and left the definition of that to private companies. So I think it was up to like 3 years ago, anybody under 13 who used Google was violating their terms of service and by definition was committing a felony.
Right.
Has there been any more coming at from that angle? Cause I think there was a mom who went on MySpace and was harassing another girl. And she got charged under CFAA because she was not a 13-year-old boy. The jury convicted her because that's what the law said. I think a judge later reversed the decision and said, you know, companies can't decide what their felony is. Is there anything, is that taking traction at all as far as that standpoint?
I'm not familiar with the Facebook case specifically.
MySpace.
But MySpace, I'm sorry. But there have, as everyone knows, in January, Aaron committed suicide, and in the aftermath of that, there have been people pushing to pass Aaron's law, which makes modifications to CFAA, which is the law that he was charged under. And one of the big changes that people were that is in Aaron's law is to remove some of the vagueness from the CFAA so that it's a lot clearer what conduct does. That is illegal and what conduct isn't. And in particular, Aaron's law looks to define unauthorized access as circumventing physical or electronic security measures. So if somebody is brute force hacking passwords, or there may be some argument that what Aaron did with the laptop might still fall under that, but simply violating terms of service it should not be a felony, because there are actually companies that have, knowing that people don't read the EULAs that come with all of their software, have put in things like "you sell me your soul" and things like that, because nobody reads them, because they're a zillion pages long and we can't change them anyway, so we click OK. And so now we've agreed to these terms of service, and then later on we find that you can't do X, Y, or Z. Is that a felony? I don't think most people would think that that's a felony.
And that's definitely an aspect of this case, which is that essentially we're using criminal law to enforce what's essentially a civilian contract. And when we cross that line, we open up all sorts of troubles. That's part of what got me convicted as well. So I'm really familiar with this.
But just corporations by proxy having the government go after people who they want to shut up, they want to shut down.
Yep.
By writing laws that are vague, I can have a big sword versus a laser. Mm-hmm. So I can say, okay, you violated the terms of agreement, and, you know, federal government indict them under whatever charge they want. They can indict you on anything they want, literally.
Yeah,
if they want you, they're going to get you.
And part
sports
of
you know that.
And part of what this also does is that since the legislators are trying to, you know, do what their customers want. It's it almost is, right?
Right.
Well, they're trying to do what the public wants, and they don't understand this sort of stuff. So people would have the most at stake. Come in and say, well, write it up this way, and it will protect all of us. And so we get things that are crappy like the DMCA and these sorts of computer crime laws that really are painted with a broad brush so that they can completely defend the stakeholders, which of course are the ones that get the guys reelected, and not at all balance it with the fact that, you know, I have to know, as a person of reasonable intelligence, when I'm reading a law, whether I'm inside or out. That's just part of the test of a law for not being vague or vague. And
yeah, just like with the speeding, with the speed limit, right? It's posted 55, 65, whatever, and so I know clearly, am I going faster than the speed limit, yes or no? Now, I think we were talking about this before the session, but sometimes around the edges, it's going to be kind of fuzzy. Well, is that exactly? But for the most part, you should really be able to tell whether or not what you're doing is illegal or getting darn close enough to being violating a law that you need to stop and think about what you're doing.
Right, I was saying, but you're in that mode, you're myopic, you're only seeing your end goal. You're not worrying about the peripherals. The periphery, that's what gets you into trouble. Randall was saying, you know, people in that level tend to think myopically, see things at the end goal versus the peripheral. In the peripheral, you know, there's a bunch of potholes that either motivated by, you know, revenue or some other entity. The thing that I've seen in the last 20, 30 years has just been the onslaught of corporations and even banks trying to control not only the flow of intellectuals. You know, the reason why Wall Street has these super high IQ people working for them, you know, because they're smart and they can get around systems. I mean, some of these laws you see are like, you know, what does it even say? You know, I'm a relatively intelligent guy, and I'm looking at it, I was like, so if I cross the street here versus there, I'm violating this law, and I can be charged by the state. If I go to this way, I'm violating the federal law, and the feds go after me. Either way, you're going to lose.
Yeah, typically, in especially state law, violent crimes, things, property crimes, as in burglary or car theft, knowledge of the law is generally not an issue, and knowledge of the law is not a defense. That's kind of one of the core tenets. But the laws have to be written in a way that if I had read that law, would I know that what I'm about to do is wrong? So for the most part, you know, someone breaks into someone's house, they know, all right, look, that's bad. Murder, okay, that's bad. But in white collar crime, it starts to get a little bit vague, especially whenever there are some of it very much is, especially if there are criminal prosecutions that can come from regulatory violations. So, you know, you could be prosecuted for like securities fraud, things like that. And a defense in some of those cases really is, how vague is this law? If I read this, would I know that what I'm doing is illegal? Like I said, that doesn't come up quite so much in most street crimes, but it does come up a lot more in federal and white collar crime.
Well, it varies from state to state, too. You can be in Tennessee, you can be in Oregon, you can be in California. That law can be written in a way that, you know, you go to Oregon, it's perfectly legal, you go to California, you know, you're breaking the law.
And just to be clear, when this all happened in Aaron's case, he was first facing state prosecution, but then he was also facing federal prosecution. And with the federal law, that's going to be the same no matter what state you're in. But you know, his state charges included breaking and entering, and there was a lot of overlap. But of course, the state charges didn't go forward, and it was his federal charges that did go forward and that were still pending at the time of his death.
It feels also a lot like RIA versus Napster and all over.
Yeah, there's going to be a panel later about peer-to-peer copyright trolling, so nice. I recommend attending that panel. It should be really interesting.
Can you talk a little bit about legal issues, if there are any? It's my understanding that the federal prosecutors knowingly overcharged to try and get him to settle on a lesser or lower charge. And
yeah.
Is it legal? Are there any legal aspects to knowingly charging for somebody with something you don't really think they did, or you don't really think the crime raises to that level? Yes,
I
mean, and I'm wondering how the law views that.
Yeah.
It's not illegal, it's unethical.
It's
Right. So the way that this works is that happens in every single case that is brought. Every single time that happens, the state is or the federal government is going to bring the most serious charges that they think they could possibly prove, and that falls under prosecutorial discretion. They're allowed to, and we do want, well, ideally we want prosecutors to have that discretion, because we want them to be able to say, okay, look, I've looked at all the facts of this case, I've looked at this defendant, and I think I'm going to exercise my prosecutorial discretion, and I'm going to charge them with only a misdemeanor, and because I know that this isn't a long-term problem person. But we also need them to be able to go, yeah, this is somebody who really does need to be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. So we, in general, or in an ideal world, prosecutorial discretion is good. But what happens in reality is that more often than not, you get the state or the government charging them the max that they think that they could possibly prove, and then using that to get them to get the defendant to plead to lesser charges. And that's exactly what happened in Aaron's case towards the end of last year, if I'm understanding the chronology right, that there had been plea discussions mostly centering around whether or not and how much, if there was any jail time, and they had gotten down to something like 3 months, and they could never quite find the right deal, because of course nobody wants to spend any time in jail or prison, and so that was what they were aiming for, nonviolent crime. That was what, yeah, you know, he would plead to felonies if there was no jail time, but the state was not willing to go to the court and say we don't want jail time, and so they couldn't just hash out bridge that last little gap. So there, in January when he passed away, there was no plea deal that looked like it was going to be sealed.
Yeah, the attorney's statement around that time of day, 2 days before Swartz's death, that he would have to spend 6 months in prison and plead guilty to 13 charges if he wanted to avoid going to trial. So that was significant and probably something that he was not interested in having happen.
You brought up Aaron's Law earlier. What's the status of that? Is that still going forward?
Oh, wow. That's a really good question. I do not. Wikipedia is going to tell us in a second. I do. I know that it hasn't been, obviously,
stay up
passed
by.
Yet,
stay up
but
by.
We're going to see how close that is to being passed.
Oh, it's a page I haven't pulled down yet. It may never come. And the top-level story has that Zoe Lofgren has introduced a bill, Aaron's Law, to exclude terms of service violations from the 86 Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and the Wire Fraud Statute. And I don't know if it's gone forward. Well, I remember Ron Wyden getting involved somehow, so let me see. Well, go ahead and ask a few more questions waiting for it to download.
Yeah, we'll research that and get back to you.
That's right. I am the research assistant today.
At what level does that kind of behavior become prosecutorial misconduct? And is that even something that has ever been successfully brought against a government, a federal government?
And criminal charges,
yeah,
you mean? Not that I'm aware of. It doesn't mean that it's never happened, but not that I'm aware of. And I would be very skeptical that it had ever happened. More likely what would happen if you had a prosecutor who was grossly abusing their authority would be that somebody would file a bar complaint against them, and they would lose their bar license. One area in which, so, and this also comes to play a little bit in Aaron's case, but there is forfeiture laws. It happens a lot more in drug cases, but anything that the government seizes in the course of an investigation, they are able to turn around and sell and use that money to fund their police force. And in here in Fulton County, there was some concern about misuse of those funds. I'm pretty sure it was in Fulton County. Misuse of the funds that were forfeited by defendants. And so if that gets too bad, I could see charges being brought for that, but not, so misuse of the forfeiture statutes, I could see charges being brought for that, but in terms of just simply overcharging defendants, I don't think that would be very likely to result in criminal prosecution of a prosecutor.
I have to say from personal experience that one of the stories I got to hear while I was funding my entire big legal team was that one of my guys on my legal team had a shadier past that he used to actually work for the drug dealers on the West Coast. And more than once, he was able to get feds and prosecutors actually fined or thrown in jail for not dotting the I's and crossing the T's as they were going after his client. So it is possible, but it requires somebody with a lot of cleverness.
On drug offenses, since they make the most money off of drug offenders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think when money is involved, I think you're more likely to see charges.
Come back tomorrow and we'll read about Aaron's Law.
How they change evidence in Aaron's case? I remember seeing a change of evidence, how they obtained the evidence.
Repeat your question, I'm sorry.
How's the chain of evidence in Aaron's case?
The chain of custody of the laptop and things like that.
Yeah.
I don't have information on that. Although when I was reading through, because MIT released a report, and of course any report that you read is going to be biased from the perspective of the author. That's just going to happen. But I was reading MIT's version of their investigation, and their retelling of how that laptop was seized seemed like that was ripe for a motion to suppress the laptop. It just seemed like the way in which it was seized did not preserve the evidence. At one point, they just sort of shut off the laptop, which, I mean, you get some forensic person in there to take a look at that. I would think that there would be definitely some discussion and litigation surrounding the one, the legality of the seizure of the laptop, and then two, whether or not any of the findings of that forensic expert were reliable.
I'm following like six cases right now where the change of evidence of the actual data on the disk versus the actual warrant for the arrest. And I'm looking at this stuff and I said, where'd you get this data from? You got it from the hard drive. Well, how'd you get the hard drive? You went to his house and picked it up. And what warrant? Mm-hmm. When they have a warrant, we told him to give us the hard drive.
Yeah, one of the still pending legal issues surrounding computer crimes is going to be the extent to which under the Fourth Amendment you can seize the actual content on a computer, because often the warrants will say, get this computer, but that's different from, or so cell phones are a real big issue, right? I'm walking around with my cell phone, I get arrested. Of course, anything that's on me is going to be subject to a search incident to arrest. So if I get arrested for one thing and I've got some pot in my pocket, I'm busted, I can't complain about that. But my cell phone isn't, I mean, that's a container. That's its own thing that they need to kind of metaphorically open up. And so they can seize my physical phone, but in some jurisdictions, in order for them to look at anything on the phone, they need a separate warrant. So my being arrested gets them the physical device, but they need to go get a warrant supported by probable cause in order for them to be able to actually look at the contents of that phone. Now, that there's a lot of disparity from jurisdiction to jurisdiction on that, but at least that's the way that I think that I do.
And 15 minutes later, yes, it looks like there's nothing, it hasn't gone forward yet. It's been discussed in committee, and the chair of the House Oversight Committee has also announced that he is investigating the actions of the Justice Department's prosecution as well. So there is some action being taken, at least at this point, that the Wikipedia article is written. And I'm not seeing anything recent in Google about Aaron's Law, so it's probably still sitting in some committee somewhere.
I think I don't follow politics much, but I think Congress is in recess right now.
Oh,
so
maybe that's
possibly.
They're perpetually in recess.
Well, right.
So in the post Aaron Swartz world that we live in right now, in essence, the federal government won. Whether you like it or not, they won by squeezing them essentially. And so, how, in your professional opinion, how do we protect ourselves from a world where there's really no impetus for the politicians to change the law, there's no impetus for the corporations to change the law, the DAs, or the district attorneys or federal attorneys, they have all the impetus to put as many charges on you as you possible, and then even squeeze you out of all your money and everything, and then not charge you at the end of the day, but your life is kind of ruined anyway.
Right.
So how do we protect ourselves? And on top of that, it doesn't seem like the government really follows the laws anyway, but besides that point.
As I said here 12 years ago, it's going to get worse before it gets better, and it may not get better.
Yeah, that and get a lawyer. I think that you have to be very cautious. And I was kind of half kidding about a lawyer, but I do think that taking a close look at what the law is, more developments as cases are coming out, as things like Aaron's Law get passed, making sure that you're up to date on your legal knowledge, right? And just acting cautiously. If you're even at all squeamish about what you're doing, it's probably better to stop and talk to someone and think about it. Because you're right, like if you cross that line, in their mind you cross that line, there's some pretty heavy consequences, even if ultimately you don't wind up with a conviction, and even more so if you do wind up with a conviction. And that's definitely something that you can talk to about, the impact of that happens long before you even wind up with the case being resolved one way or another, but just from the moment of arrest or even investigation, the extreme negative impact that being under investigation has on your life.
Yeah, I mean, like, one of the things that's happened for me in the 12 years, 15 years since the conviction, is that it's had a chilling effect on the kinds of things I will do with my life. I really can't work at computer security anymore because people don't want me around their deepest secrets now because I can't be trusted for that sort of stuff, says in theory. And I also can't go to, like, hacker cons because, you know, I'm going to be the guy they're going to go look for. They're going to follow me around because I have the actual criminal record and all that stuff. So it's really sort of impacted me on that level. I think you also speak more to the impact on career and things, though, right?
Yeah, for all aspects of your life, career, right. and financial, right. Personal.
And my case ultimately cost me $270,000. And I make decent money, but that's still a significant chunk of many years' worth of money, many years' worth of income. And while the case was being prosecuted, of course, my my time was tied up going to court and dealing with my lawyers and just kind of hanging out and trying to find gigs I could get that started to pay down some of the bills. But the biggest thing for me, and I think I can relate to Aaron on this. I didn't speak to him, so I don't know this for a fact. But one of the biggest issues for me when I was first confronted by the police was that I'm in this profession. I studied my entire life to get good at being in computers. And if this case was successfully prosecuted, what would be my chance of getting another job anywhere in the computer industry? So everything that I had worked forward to be was at risk because of this potential conviction. Now, as it turns out, I overestimated the possible impact, and thank goodness, or I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you today. But I have to say, at least a couple of times during the prosecution, I was suicidal because everything that I had invested in was on the table at risk. And so that's why I can totally relate to what Aaron was probably feeling about this as well. I mean, it's more than just spending some time in jail. It's the continual stigma that comes with that. I can't go to Canada or Australia still. That's really weird that the places that have felons are the places I can't go, but it's how it works. I can go to UK just fine, though. I don't know why. They let me go upstream, but not downstream, I guess. So I still, even though, as I told some of you here a few years ago, my case was expunged by the state, but the feds don't recognize that. So I can't get, like, the early entry programs to come into the states through the short line and a lot of other things. I'm probably still not eligible for federal programs, like if I did something for the Small Business Administration. I haven't tried, but that's on my record now forever, even though it's technically expunged. I can tell you as a potential employer, I've never been convicted of a crime. That's between you and me. But the feds still have a black mark by my name, and that'll stay with me for the rest of my life.
one other thing about criminal histories is that even if it's expunged in terms of it being disclosed when an employer or someone like that runs an NCIC or some sort of criminal history, the federal government, state governments will always see that expunged or not. So it goes away in some ways, and in other very real ways, it's going to always be there.
Tainted for life. Good thing I'm not eternal.
I'm sorry, you've been having had that mic for like 5 minutes.
That's fine. So I'm hearing sort of this narrative of we're not powerful and you don't like what we do, and so people can be legally, although unethically, harassed. And I think that's a really common experience. And I'm wondering if there is sort of room for a more intersectional move towards social justice in general, because I think this is a really common experience for a lot of people. I mean, you think about stop and frisk in communities of color and sort of the long-term effects of interacting with the legal system for a lot of people, and not just people in this room. And I'm wondering if there's kind of space to take this common experience and move forward in a bigger way that's about kind of legal social justice for everybody, rather than kind of this specific group here and this specific group here, if it would be more powerful to integrate those movements.
I'd just like to add to that. I saw a tweet around this time, about the overcharging and the plea bargain, and if the only lesson that we draw from this is, a well-connected person this happened to, then we've drawn the wrong lesson.
Yeah, I think that might have gotten lost a little bit, but as much as I think that we should be paying attention to Aaron's case, things like this happen constantly to, especially to people of color, especially to people with little financial or political power, and we don't hear about it. There aren't laws passed in order to address it. We just sort of accept it as, well, if they didn't do this, then they must have done something else, or that's the cost that we pay in order to keep our community safe. And so I definitely agree that one thing that I would like to see would be to take this lesson of vague laws, overzealous prosecutions, and understand that this happens to so many people, and that we should be spending, I think that we should be spending more time just thinking about the ways in which we go about prosecuting crime and how we define justice, because we often define justice as a conviction and not as somebody having a fair trial, or even laws being equally applied to everybody. Absolutely, so you are absolutely right.
It's coming to Sweden soon. Just takes a while.
I wanted to make a comment, really, in falling back on your question, which is how do we then act? And your response was to be a bit more cautious, and I think that's a very
sad.
That's my point. I think that's expected response from an attorney. It's a very prudent response that we should all be more cautious, but. I think it's important to think about what that change in behavior as a society means, and I think it, in light of, I'm not sure that really honors Aaron's memory. I don't think that particular collective change in behavior that we all become more cautious is the response he would have wanted.
By the way, that wasn't legal advice. I'm not giving legal advice. I don't.
What does it mean for us to be more cautious, and why are we even asking that of ourselves, to be more cautious? I mean, what kind of scenario has been? Pardon?
Things that they did not do or knew little of or limited knowledge of.
and accept please in order to.
And then what they get you is they say, okay, you charged with 10 felonies, okay, but because you know jail time, you pleaded this. And once you pleaded that felony, well, some people say, yeah, I did wrong. He was telling you, you tagged for life. You're not tagged for how long, you tagged for life.
And worse than that, if it's a bad case, it sets bad case law. So the prosecutors can go even further the next time because they go, well, look, we got an advance or an examination of this particular action resulted in two felonies guilty.
It reverberates through the whole
It actually can stretch out. Like one of the things we were worried about with my case is that if my case went successfully to prosecution, who else would be convicted under Oregon's really bad computer crime law? And in fact, there was a conviction not a few months after mine went down where they were able to get a woman who had taken money out of a drawer, out of a cash register, and they got her not because of the amount of money she took, which was only like $20, so it wasn't even like it was a misdemeanor, right? But because the cash register was a computer, they cited her under the Computer Crime Act and got her a full felony on it.
Wow, that's massive overreach.
Exactly.
we know more than most of us are curious. So that curiosity will cost you. And by being curious, just by nature being curious, you want to expose yourself to different things. And by exposure, you learn. And that's how you become better at what you do. Crap. You've been doing it for 20, 30 years now. Randall's been doing it forever. Hope that I get there one day. He got there because he learned and curious. But the bar now is set at a level that if you come to that bar, if you dare to come to that bar, you're going to come after.
Yeah, so that's what I was kind of alluding to, was that I understand that the prudent nature is caution, and the reason it's caution is because as an IT employee or in the IT community, as one community, we understand those boundaries better than the DA. Or judges, or juries, or whoever else we might, the public in general, that we're gonna be faced to decide our fate in that sense. And that's the scary part, because it would take, my mom still calls me to ask, how to do something on an iPad. Mm-hmm. If I have to convince a judge that what I did wasn't illegal, because there's thousands of IT employees doing it the same thing every day, that's an uphill battle that you as an IT person, you had to face, instead of the laws being the corrected to apply to our industry properly.
Well, I mean, it is one thing we can do is that here we are on the EFF track, supporting the EFF and their ability to generate Friends of the Court briefs and participate. I know that Mike Godwin actually got me started on my prosecution. Well, I guess it's prosecution of me, yes, but he actually helped me get started, helped me find a local lawyer to get moving and how to look for somebody that was good at that.
Who doesn't even have like a bare minimum knowledge of these things should even be able to jury on these. Juries. You shouldn't be allowed to if you don't have basic knowledge.
Yeah.
How about somebody investigating you? We have a case now, I'm going to report cases right now. I live in a small city in the southeast, a population of 10,000 people. In the last 6 years, we had 16 cases of target pornography. What's been coming on, 16 cases, the population that size? Nobody said anything. Comes out, this local sheriff was prosecuting these people who were political enemies of his, who was putting pornography on these article, theoretically, allegedly, putting pornography on these guys' laptops, taking those laptops, analyzing them, finding his files, and indicting those people. There's six people. And actually, the guy turned himself in a while ago. He's got a tweet from a friend of mine that says he turned himself in, 27 counts, felony counts against him. This is the sheriff. So it depends on people who are investigating.
Yeah, I do think that there is a certain amount of technical knowledge that needs to be, the investigators need to have it, the district attorneys need to have it, the defense attorneys need to have it, judges and court staff need to have it. And it's actually the responsibility of the district attorney and the defense attorneys to educate the judge and to weed out people. I'm a firm believer that everybody, I know a lot of people don't like jury duty, but I think that it's, obviously, I think that it's very, very important. But there are some cases that people are better suited to sit on than others, and there are some people that I would rather have trying. I would rather try a case in front of a computer case in front of a jury that has some computer knowledge, or depending on how bad my case is, maybe I want to be able to be the person telling them, explaining and giving the context for what's going on, and I don't necessarily want somebody who is going to take their outside knowledge, because that would also be improper for people to take their knowledge from what they've learned outside of the courtroom and bring that into the jury room, right? They're only allowed to consider things that are presented in court, so you have to be a little bit careful about that. But, you know, I don't know.
You also have to keep in mind, though, that I would never be on a jury panel
right
now. You know, I'm too smart. They're going to take me off right in the first round.
Well, I was more thinking because, well, it's expunged, but I was thinking more along those lines than too smart. But I
was told as we were, you know, we were discussing how the jury selection would happen, and what they want is people that can be swayed. And so a smart person tends to make positions early and from facts, and the both sides sort of want to be able to do hand waving a little bit and get you kind of moving one way or the other. And if you're too smart, that doesn't happen.
So one of the things with with CFAA, you know, it's very clear. My son can go to Chuck E. Cheese's. He puts money in the machine. If he randomly wins, he gets a ticket and he can go get a prize. I do that at a casino for $20. That's illegal. It's very clear that Chuck E. Cheese's still exists. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, they haven't applied any sort of common sense for that in CFAA, because as we learned this morning, you can do passive monitoring of Wi-Fi, right? Mm-hmm. If nobody can test to see what's going on, then all we're relying on is for the people who do criminal activity. They're trying to take credit card numbers and all that kind of stuff. Serious stuff, they're the only ones that know it. And so with the bar being so low, it impacts us to actually do the research we need to do to figure out what our vulnerabilities are.
So I think that the thought that I was having as you're asking your question was that one of the goals of Aaron's Law is to preserve the ability to prosecute what we would, by our common sense, consider to be computer crimes. Physical circumvention of security measures, you know, electronic hacking of passwords, things like that, stealing of credit card numbers, those things, you know, the goal of Aaron's Law is for those to remain illegal because we recognize that those are harmful, but to not criminally prosecute people for things that are just terms of service violations. So it's trying to put some sort of common sense, like you were talking about, into the application of this, but I still think that it's going to come down to prosecutors. The common sense is going to come more from the prosecutors. I don't know if it's exactly easy to write common sense into a law and still have it be flexible enough to be useful as a tool to stop crime.
Could a DA go to Chuck E. Cheese's
I have not read the gambling laws in Georgia. Like, there's like the lotto, but we don't have casinos, and so that hasn't been something that I've really looked at.
You don't win currency at the end, you win tangible item. It's why like car lotteries and the mall are legal.
It's games of skill versus games of chance.
I think as long as you're not getting a physical currency payout at the end, you're getting some kind of tangible item. You know, like in Japan, they have their, technically, technically illegal, but I just so happened to get some tokens in this machine and walk around the corner to a guy at a stand who then changed me money and tokens. So then it's not technically gambling.
I also, there may be some minimum value happening there. I don't think anything that you win at Chuck E. Cheese would realistically be considered a thing of value. Now if they start giving out cars, maybe people start talking a little bit more about gambling, but
A talking Chuck E. Cheese doll is not invaluable?
I think that there's a case up on appeal now about whether or not the talking Chuck E. Cheese dolls are things of value. I'm kidding.
We only have a couple more minutes.
Yep. You had a question?
Any more questions?
Yeah. Comments?
Well, yeah, more comments. I just had two thoughts, and I think Aaron, wasn't he the creator of RSS?
He was involved in it. I don't know.
He was on the committee. I don't know what his exact involvement was.
Right. Okay. And it's just an expansion. What the cost of society of expanding everything into criminal cases? You know, over criminalization of acts and making everything a criminal case, and then losing someone like that, an innovator like that, that I don't think we can afford to lose in this ever more competitive world. Yeah. I don't think we can afford to lose almost anybody, but then,
right.
You know, a case like this really puts it out there, I mean, for hopefully to make people think about it. And then, and it was interesting, you made a comment, Randall, I don't write manifestos because I don't want to get in trouble again, and that's also a cost. I mean, if people that are innovators like you, you know, are afraid to say anything, or afraid to do anything, how are we going to push boundaries? How are we going to go for it? And when we're competing with other societies where they're not, you know, they're not scared to go out and try stuff or challenge things, or, you know, are not worried about over prosecution, you know, if they want to go out and learn about something that we've deemed, oh, it's suspicious if you even want to read about this or look about this. And
yeah, I can't.
That's my thoughts.
Thank you. And I can't make comments sometimes on public cases because I don't want to get on anybody's radar again. And so, yeah, that's a chilling effect for me. I know a lot about this stuff, having been through it and directly through it, and I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy, but I have to bite my tongue as I'm watching people discuss this right now.
And I think that's such a loss for us as a society. You know?
It leaves the case leaves open the question of whether or not the violation, because if the idea here was that one of the reasons why Aaron wanted to download this data was to make it publicly available so that we all had access to this information, which is something that I think that we all agree is good, but it's made illegal, then one of the undercurrents that I sense in this discussion is whether or not there's this difference between something being illegal and something being immoral, right? Is the greater good of violating this law worth the risk of prosecution? And I mean, that's, you know, an individual question, and I offer no legal advice on that. But I mean, there are instances in which that I could definitely see where society may benefit from something that may be technically against the law. Exactly.
It's not benefiting the people, it's benefiting the minority who's making a bunch of money off of it.
The stakeholders, the owners. Yeah. No. Not conspiracy. All right. Well, thank you all for coming.
Thanks.